The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Space Show today, Monday, June 6th. And I suppose most of you know what very, very famous day this is in history. And so we certainly dedicate the Space Show to those brave, brave, brave men and women who actually performed miracles on this day many, many, many years ago, which is why we're all here for the most part. And so we remember D-Day certainly on the Space Show, and I hope all of you do as well, and the people who gave so much to win so much. On to the Space Show today. Let's make a couple of routine announcements and then get on with our program. If you would like to call and talk to Bob Zimmerman, who is our guest today, that toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screener. Do let the phone ring. We'll answer it as soon as possible and bring you up on air as soon as possible. And then for those of you who want to use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com is working fine this morning, so we'll leave that as it is. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You can download shows. You can share the MP3 files. You can pass them around. Please don't edit them. Don't do anything commercial with them. And transcripts are not permitted. And if you have any questions or comments or you have any specific ideas for a Space Show program, please let me hear from you. Just send me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we do podcasts. We thank Andrew over at gigadial.net for our podcasting. We're in iTunes, Podcast Alley, Zune, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and a host of other places. So if you have any podcasting questions, do let us know. The RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast is on both our website newsletter, our email newsletter, and it is also on our website. Visit our website, thespaceshow.com. Remember, the comprehensive newsletter is posted usually Sunday evening. It has all of the details of the week's programming. It has all the full details on the guest bio. It's the only place where we have a future events section. And if we have to make any announcements or change programming, this is where you'll see it first. So do check it out from time to time to stay current. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily download these programs. There's a Space Show store. You'll see it up near the top of the website. It's called Space Show Gear. And then you'll also see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation.org. And this program only exists because of your gifts and generosity. And we appreciate those of you who do support us and those of you who will be supporting us. If you have any questions, let me hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And as I said a few minutes ago, before I tell you a little bit about Bob Zimmerman, you probably don't need to know much about him because he's on the show so often and you all know him. But do remember that we are brought to you by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. So, yes, Bob Zimmerman is back with us. And he has a great website. It's http://behindtheblack, that's all one word, behindtheblack.com, just address space issues, but also science and a lot of other interest articles relating to culture, politics. You should add it to your daily reading, absolutely. And you can also comment back to Bob on his website. He is a space historian. He's a very well-known author. He has written some great books that we've talked about on the space show, The Universe in a Mirror, The Saga of the Hubble Space Telescope, and The Visionaries Who Built It. He also wrote Earth, Space Stations, Rival Superpowers, and The Quest for Interplanetary Travel, and many, many others. He writes articles in various magazines that all of you know about, things like the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, American History, etc. And so rather than continuing to read about Bob Zimmerman, let's talk to him again. And Bob, welcome back to the Space Show. And I guess the opening question is, since you were last on, do we still have a space program?
David, I'm glad to be here. It's always a pleasure. We enjoy talking, and I love hearing feedback from your listeners. Do we have a space program? Well, you know, program is, it's the curse word, the assumption everyone always makes. We must have a program. And that goes back to the theme of my long essay on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's speech that I posted on my website, titled We Stand for Freedom. Why do we keep asking for a program? We must have a organized program. I want chaos. I want freedom to determine how we get to space. I've wanted that all my life. That's what we supposedly went to space in the 60s to prove, that freedom works better. And having a space program only fits it into a box badly, and hasn't for 50 years now, has not gotten us where we want to be, which is with a true space-faring, robust industry where real exploration is possible. So, do we have a space program? I hope not. And I think, either wittingly or unwittingly, David, the Obama administration is working as hard as it can to not give us one. And I say that a little facetiously. I wrote recently on the website talking about the costs of getting up into space and the politics behind the program right now, and the COTS program and the crew cargo development program versus the NASA built program that Congress wants. Those political battles all revolve still around whether or not the Obama administration is serious about trying to have commercial companies provide services to NASA. And though I had serious doubts about them right from the beginning, they seem to try and want to hold that course. And I give them credit for at least trying to hold that course. I prefer commercial companies privately owned building the rockets to get us into space and the capsules. I prefer to have a lot of those companies competing with each other for business that will lower the cost, so that it won't be just NASA buying the product, but private companies as well, private people. So I give the Obama administration for credit for at least appearing to hold that course. They are so bad at what they do in terms of politics that they haven't done a very good selling job at Congress. And whether or not the funding from that program will survive in the atmosphere as it presently exists today remains a very big unknown.
Well, the problem is the government programs to build rockets and get us into space have either retired or being canceled or are being dismantled. So the truth is, if the U.S. is going to get cargo to ISS and is going to get humans to space, then the privates are the only way at this point.
Well, you know, Congress has its fantasy that their heavy lift rocket and Orion capsule will fill the boat. And I have doubts about that. And I don't believe it'll ever get built. I don't think the money is sufficient or the time is sufficient to do it. They'll just spend a lot of money on pork. But that program still exists. And Orion capsule, that's getting built. It just doesn't have any launch capability. You know, if they were smart, they would configure it to put it on more than just one rocket built by NASA. And I think actually I've seen something. So you might be able to clarify this, but I think I've seen something where Lockheed is trying to configure it so it can be launched by more than just like Ares. Since they know Ares is probably not going to get built anyway, so they need to reconfigure it so it can be launched by something else. And so, yes, do we have a space program? Once again, I don't care if we have a program, and I don't think a program's gotten us into space. So if the NASA government-built rocket dies because they don't have enough money, and then Congress, because of the budget situation, cuts the commercial program, and that's possible, they might be happy just dumping all the money into the pork to keep their jobs open in their districts, and then cutting everything else. That could happen. We could then end up with no space program at all. But the need to get into space is still going to be there. There is definitely a need. The government has a need. And so if they don't have a program to subsidize these companies in advance, they're going to want to buy the product down the road. And Bigelow, who has his space stations, is going to want to buy the product because he's got customers who want to use his space modules. And so I think that a space industry is going to appear in the next few years to fulfill the need, whether or not we have a program or not. That's how I see it, David. I might be too optimistic, but I'm always an optimist. That's what I think will happen.
Well, if you look at the funding going into, say, CCDEV2, and the companies receiving the funding, there's Blue and Sierra Nevada and SpaceX and the Boeing Consortium and someone else.
No, those are the four companies.
Oh, okay, those are the four. I got them all.
CCDEV money, yeah.
So
you were thinking of Orbital Sciences got money in the COTS program.
In the COTS program.
Company, but
yeah.
It's COTS.
So you know, and they all claim they need this money for their R&D development, you know, to get them to the point where they're going to get closer to being operational. I don't think this is going to take them to operations, but it probably takes them theoretically to a demo flight or something like that. So the question is, if Congress cut the funding, and I personally don't think they're going to do that, but if they did pull the funding out for, say, CCDEV2, would these companies fund themselves to demo flight to the same point in time?
That's a good question.
You know, SpaceX probably could do it. Blue could probably do it just because of who owns the companies, right?
Right.
Boeing is a little bit different position because they're a publicly held company with fiduciary obligations, and I don't...
Sierra Nevada?
No, Boeing.
I know, but I'm there. The next one is Sierra Nevada.
Sierra Nevada is privately held, so if they're sufficiently funded to do that, they're a privately held company, they could do it. I don't know how sufficiently funded they are. I think Boeing would have some fiduciary and public stockholder considerations on doing it, but they might. I mean, they clearly could, right?
The list of companies is very revealing because SpaceX and Sierra Nevada and Blue Origin are all very independently owned companies,
right,
that have proceeded on their own initiative. They have not. They're not owned by NASA, at least in terms of what their goals are. Their goals are their own goals, and they've just linked those goals to where they see a customer is, and that's NASA, and where there's possible funding. NASA. They're looking at NASA, I think, as an investor in this respect. I mean, it's a way to look at it. So, should NASA's funding go away? Well, you know, SpaceX has designed its Falcon 9 rocket not simply as a cargo and crew rocket to get to ISS. It's designed to get satellites into space, and they have contracts. I pointed this out on my website, how they have not been making a lot of launches with either the Falcon 1E, the enhanced version, or the Falcon 9.
They've flown the 1E, have they?
Well, the 1E is basically an upgrade of Falcon 1. They have contracts, and they have contracts that say they would be starting to do regular launches right now. As you and others have noted when I asked this question on Behind the Black, Elon Musk has indicated he wants to hold off doing anything until they want to focus on Falcon 9 and Dragon. And I think there's both management reasons for doing that, and he's got political reasons for doing it. If he has a failure on Falcon 1 and a Falcon 9 commercial launch while he's trying to get money from Congress, obviously it'll hurt his political position in that game. So holding off those other launches reduces the risk. So that's one political reason. But, you know, once again, if they lose the funding from NASA, SpaceX, very particularly, is not helpless. They will just go on and try to make money in the commercial market. And the track record of that particular company and Musk, their CEO, is to pump money back into the company to increase its capabilities. And so that money will go into that program to either make the Falcon 9 crew capable regardless of NASA's funding. I'd expect that. Or they would pump the money in to build a Falcon Heavy. And I would expect that from them. And I think I'd expect some variation of the same thing from Blue Origin and Sierra Nevada. Those companies have worked on their own initiative to try to develop a business that they can make money outside of the government till. I'm not sure exactly where Blue Origin's goals are. They're very secretive. But nonetheless, they have worked on their own. And Sierra Nevada has tried to just find funding and make a business independent of the government, or at least independent of government goals. And I think those companies will proceed, if they can, especially SpaceX, because if they can make a profit, they'll continue to make that profit, and they'll use the money to build something.
Well, again, I don't think they're going to cut CCDEV 2 or I guess CCDEV 3 coming up. But what would be really interesting is if they did do that, and so SpaceX, let's just leave the discussion on SpaceX, they continue with crew capability and Dragon and all of that. So if they no longer are taking government money, they could possibly, say, stick it to oversight from NASA.
Yeah.
If they, it would, let's put it this, it'd be much easier to say stick it to the oversight.
Right? They would say stick it.
So now would the government
just simply not? They'd lead the way once again.
So would government, without or with very very minimum human oversight, fly astronauts on Dragon to the station? That would be a very interesting question to debate and to deliberate on.
See,
I don't know the answer to it.
I think in terms, David, always of what the political realities will be. If, for example, this is speculation, but if there is no money for the crew development program and SpaceX has to go on its own and then has a product that can provide crew capability to get up to ISS, and it won't be Russian-made, it'll be American-made, the political reality is that NASA will get money to buy the product from SpaceX, especially if SpaceX starts to sell that crew capability to various companies like Space Adventures, who want to put tourists into space. You know, once they've started to fly the ship, or they sell it to Bigelow, for example, with passengers, why should NASA sit back and say, "Oh no, you're not following our rules"? At that point, it becomes irrelevant.
Well, because it depends on how risk averse and cautious NASA would be in
the political realities are what count, and the political realities will force any administration, not NASA bureaucrats, force NASA, any administration, to begin to buy the product from SpaceX. Those rules will suddenly become very easy to achieve. Those regulations, the demand rating, it'll happen. Because politically, they'll say it has to happen. It's one of the reasons I don't like giving a lot of power to government, because it has nothing to do with law and a fair standard. It has to do with the political realities. And so sometimes the political realities put big restrictions on people, and sometimes political realities allow the rules to be just tossed aside.
Well,
and I think the rules will get tossed aside in this situation. Political realities will force them to buy SpaceX products.
Well, my crystal ball shows that CCDEV and crew and all this is going to continue to be funded, even if NASA watches Congress dump its budget, you know, down to 15.
I think you're correct.
17 billion.
But you know, once again, the Obama administration requested something like $800 million for the crew development program, which was significantly more than they got last year. They're not going to get that money.
No,
they're going to get less than half that. They'll probably get something comparable to what they've gotten last year and the year before. And the small amounts of money will, I think, will be good, because it will, once again, it'll force these companies to be smart about what they're doing instead of having a gigantic cash flow.
In your opinion, are they going to permit mammoth sucking in cost overruns with James Webb on the entire NASA budget?
Well, wait, I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, Webb is part of the astrophysics department.
Well, that's right.
A different problem completely.
Well, but they're funding NASA with $18 billion.
Yeah.
And as Webb keeps consuming everything, then if that budget is going to pay for things other than Webb, it's going to have to take from other parts of NASA. Otherwise, it's just going to be all their, that's going to be
in
a sold product.
Specifically, I think it's a separate issue. Because, you know, the scientists have always tried to blame Manspace for getting their astrophysics program
down. Yeah, well, not
this time.
But
that's
never
been the case.
Yeah.
And in this case, they're still separate issues. The budget of NASA has a certain amount in it for astrophysics. That money is sufficient to build Webb. The problem is that that money is insufficient to build anything else.
To do anything else. So that's what I mean. So if they're content doing only Webb,
that's all they're going to do.
Then okay. If they want to do Webb and something else, and they have a shrinking NASA budget, then that's where my comment comes into play.
Yeah, the situation is at this moment, because of the tight budget situation and the federal deficit and debt that exists, the NASA and also most of these agencies are facing, maybe for the first time in our lifetimes, real cuts. We're not now talking about a reduction in the increase in their budget, which is what's been happening when they call it cuts in the last 50 years. We're talking about real cuts. In other words, they got $18 billion this year. They might only get $17 billion next year. And what that means is that all aspects of what NASA does face a belt tightening. When it comes to astrophysics, it essentially means that they're not going to build pretty much anything except Webb this decade. They've got to get it finished. They might do some planetary missions because that's a slightly different budget item once again. But the actual astronomy budget, they're not going to build anything.
What accounts for the massive Webb overruns?
Oh, it's a good question. James Webb, as a telescope, well, let's go back to Hubble. I wrote about this in Universe and Mirror. The Hubble Space Telescope was not cutting-edge technology, engineering. They knew how to build a mirror of sufficient precision from military work, and that's one of the reasons they approved building Hubble, because they knew they could do something already from the top secret military work that had been ongoing in the late 60s. So when they were building Hubble, it was not super cutting-edge technology. There was cutting-edge technology involved, but most of the stuff had been tested and built in some configuration prior to the launch of Hubble. And so from that consideration, there weren't as many risks in the construction. That's the first thing about Hubble that's different than Webb. The second thing is they built Hubble to be repaired by humans. And so there was a little bit of margin. If you didn't get it exactly right in the initial construction, you knew you had an opportunity to fix it later, which meant you didn't have to. So those two factors together means with Webb, it won't be maintainable by humans. It's going to be put into an orbit a million miles from Earth, so there'll be no way astronauts can get to it. And two, with Webb, everything is cutting edge. There's no technology, there was no military technology that needed this kind of construction before. Everything they're doing for Webb is on the edge of the unknown in terms of engineering. So it's incredibly difficult and challenging, and that's one of the reasons the costs have gone up. And it also means because they can't maintain it, they have to get it right. So they don't have any margin of error at all. And so that forces the costs up. And those two factors alone are pushing this telescope. The original budget was a little over $1 billion. It's now six plus. And it was supposed to be launched this year, and it won't be launched until 16 at the earliest. So those are the basic factors that have pushed Webb's cost way out into the stratosphere. And I do not see anything to reduce the costs down the road, because they're still dealing with an incredibly difficult and risky space mission.
Well, do you think they'll keep funding it, or would they kill it too?
No, they're not going to kill it. I mean, the standard government operating procedure here is a buy-in. It's the same thing to do with Hubble. Once you've invested this much capital, government, they'll keep pouring the money in until they get it launched. And the astronomy community is committed to it. They're stuck. They have to get it built and get it launched. The thing that that Webb will do once in space will be quite incredible. It will teach us things about the Big Bang that have never been seen before. He'll be able to look farther than Hubble can. And so it's not optical, but because it's infrared, it can look deeper into the redshifted far universe. And for that reason, it'll be able to see things much closer to the Big Bang than anything we've got now. So the science is just, is too, no one wants to lose the opportunity to do that science. So no, they're not going to cancel it at this point. The only thing that gets canceled right now, David, is the possibility, and this isn't out of the realm of reality, that the government just doesn't have any money for anything anymore, and all luxuries go away. And web is a luxury. There's no doubt about that. It is not, it is a surplus item in a wealthy society that a wealthy society can afford. If our government goes belly up and the economy collapses, and these are not outside the realm of reality, a possibility, then web won't get built. But it won't be, that won't happen because they've chosen to stop funding it. It's because they don't, they literally don't have the money anymore.
Well, I don't think they'll, I think there'll be enough wisdom to not let the country go belly up and fail. But, you know, there are days when you really don't know, because I don't know what the collective wisdom is of the people, you know, in charge of policy.
We get the government we deserve. I mean, this is not a political show, but we get the government we deserve. If the nation chooses to start looking maturely at the debt and the deficit, we can fix the problem before disaster strikes. But if the country still refuses to maturely look at those problems, and this applies to NASA as well, then we will collapse. There's no question of it. This is human nature. It's history, and that's just the way it works.
Well,
if you don't face your problems honestly, then your problems come to bite you. If you don't face them, when they try to bite you, they'll bite you from behind in the worst possible place. And we want to avoid that if we can help it.
I don't think the public still sees space as a priority for anything.
No, space is definitely in terms of budget items like this, space has always been a low priority. And in fact, it's why I don't want the government involved, because I think the public has a valid reason to not want their tax dollars coerced into this particular program. It should be customers buying the product voluntarily. And when the government needs the product, they should buy the product voluntarily like everybody else from a suite of free companies.
Here's an email question from you. It's our first one of the day. It's Richard in Los Angeles. And Richard says, there seems to be lots of mixed messages coming out of NASA as to what our policy should be. Should it be more or less the government building rockets? Should it be the commercial path that many talk about and want to promote? But there doesn't seem to be a unified NASA in any of this. How harmful is that? And is there a way for NASA to finally get its house in order and take a unified approach? And what do you think it would be?
All right. It says an excellent question. He has just described in just a few sentences what I've written about several times on Behind the Black about the schizophrenic, confused nature of the Obama administration in this matter. Obama is a very left-wing, almost socialist president, and that's not meant as an insult. That's a statement of fact. He believes that government is a vehicle for making the world better. He sincerely believes that, and he wants to use government to achieve his ends in that manner. So his approach to NASA has been incredibly contradictory to that approach, because in the case of space exploration and the aerospace industry and NASA, he has instead chosen to say, no, government is not the way to do it. Instead, we should have private enterprise doing it, and then government will buy the product, which is a very conservative approach, if anything. So that alone is kind of, for the Obama administration, is kind of schizophrenic. It's going against their general beliefs. And so I think that's contributed to the confusion that the listener sees coming from the Obama administration. In addition, one of the reasons that the listener senses confusion is because the Obama administration, when it plays politics, is generally very confused. And I don't mean that as a negative. They don't play the political game on Capitol Hill or to the public with any nuance or savvy. They are tone deaf when it comes to politics, and they continually shoot themselves in the foot and hurt themselves politically by their actions. And when it comes to NASA, they have sold this commercial idea very poorly. They have negotiated with Congress even more so badly, because you need to negotiate a deal with Congress, and they didn't do it very well. In fact, they didn't try in the slightest. And so the result of that is that Congress has balked and has fought them every step of the way. So now how do you fix that? Well, you need to have an administration in power that both knows what it wants and also has some savvy about going about and getting it. In that case, you want a unified policy for NASA that makes some sense. Maybe you just need a different administration. It's simple as that. I hope that answers the question.
Well, if it doesn't, we'll hear from Richard. But if,
sure.
In terms of it answering the question to my satisfaction, in all the years I have known the space community, forget NASA, let's just zero it off of the table, I have never seen our space community as absolutely divided and in some aspects of it so angry and so vehemently opposed to any view other than their own view. To even use the word partisan is an understatement. There are segments in the space industry that seriously consider we're at war to achieve their vision of what a space policy or a space program should be.
You know, you're describing actually an overall cultural problem the nation has right now. People are not willing. People have become too partisan. They are not willing to listen even reasonably to what those they disagree with are saying. Facts are important in that debate, and that's what counts. And the country has a serious problem right now.
Yeah, but it's my facts, not yours.
Well, you know, there are times, though, when the proper knowledge does rise to the surface, and there have been, in many issues, areas where people are not willing to debate honestly. And that implies with space as well. Look, I could talk about the cost of cargo. The House charter for the hearings 2 weeks ago had a so-called paperwork in it which said that the shuttle is cheaper than the crew development program, the commercial space people. It'll be cheaper per pound to launch it. And that data was fudged. It made it appear the shuttle was cheaper, and they did that by increasing the so-called launch rate per year and by using an unrealistic annual budget for NASA. And by doing that, they made it look, they faked it. And it's very important that people look at the facts as they are and then make decisions. And we have too many people who are not willing, too much of the debate in Capitol Hill nowadays is just spinning and faking data rather than dealing with data that's real. And that's very disturbing, and that's where the problem is.
Well, except that I heard from people who work in shuttle that said that those numbers were realistic, and you know, to say that they faked it is a pretty strong statement.
They stated in that charter that the cost to operate the shuttle per year was $3 billion a year. The shuttle doesn't cost $3 billion a year. The only reason the last 3 years or so it's been listed as costing only $3 billion a year is because they've been shutting the program down. So certain parts of the program don't cost any money anymore. But when the shuttle program was full and alive and functioning and not being closed, it cost $4 billion a year every year to do that program. It averaged $4 billion a year. That's just the way it was. And to say it was $3 billion and to just state and then state that, oh, that proves that the shuttle's cheaper is absurd. And then to say that you do an average of 4 flights a year, the shuttle hasn't averaged 4 flights a year in
10 years, probably 15 years.
Oh, more than that. It averages a little over 3 flights a year. It was potentially built to do more than that. And before the Challenger accident, they were trying to get up to 9 flights, 10 monthly flights. But they just don't have the funds for that. If you do raise the launch rate, you're going to begin to incur additional costs, and that $4 billion a year will go up because the shuttle is a NASA government design program and run by the government. It can't go down in cost. So those people who are saying the shuttle is really this cheap are not being honest, because the actual budget numbers, it just costs more. That's just the bottom line. And I think the shuttle is one of the greatest spacecraft, most incredible spacecraft ever built. Its capabilities far exceed anything else that has it exists today or will exist for probably decades. For a reasonable cost, considering the capabilities. But nonetheless, it's too expensive for private, for the cost. We want to get into space cheaper, and what we should really be looking for is ways to innovate to getting access to space cheaper. And then, as time passes and the industry becomes more mature, we will start to regain the capabilities of the shuttle, but at a lower cost. Because this is just too cutting edge right now, and no one can afford to pay it except the federal government. So, no, I'm sorry. Those numbers were spun numbers to make it look like the shuttle and the government program is the way to go, and crew development is not.
Well, maybe someone listening who works with it will call in to challenge you on the language you're using, like spun numbers or something like that, and refute them. With you, I was trying to real quickly call up the. I used to know the URL for the page that had the number of shuttle flights each year, I'd like to see when the last time they.
I'm behind the black clock. Lindsay had posted a comment to my essay on the cost of cargo, noting that the average launch rate is 3.3 a year, and that sounds about right.
No, I agree. I just like to know when we really did four flights a year, how many years ago it was.
I do know that before the Challenger accident, and that's in '86. It's a long time ago. It's 25 years. There was the launch rate was about they were up to 9, 8, 7, 8, 9 a year. They were pushing those numbers, but after Challenger, it never reached those numbers again. I think the best year they had was like 5 flights after that. And you know, I could sit and pull out my encyclopedia of chronological encyclopedia, and I could tell you every flight that took place through from '86 to '99, and I think the rates are pretty much the same since then. So once again, the rates are less than that charter said, and two, they based their numbers on the final years of the program when they were shutting the program down. They weren't building external tanks anymore. They were closing the program down. Costs were going down because they weren't doing as much. So those are not realistic numbers.
There are people who still want the shuttle to keep flying. Do you see any way? I mean, there's even a group. They were on the John Batchelor show about 2 weeks ago, I think the 25th of May or something, talking about keeping the shuttle going. I don't see any possible way that's going to happen.
I mean, it's just, once again, political realities. Think about this. Remember my position. I've wrote about this on Behind the Black. I thought the Obama administration, for negotiating reasons, should have offered to extend the shuttle program 3 years ago as a bone to throw to Congress to therefore get the commercial space program they wanted. They could have canceled Constellation. They would have had the jobs from the shuttle program, and they then could have gotten good funding for, I think, the commercial space program. So I was in favor of extending the shuttle. So I want to preface my comments because right now it's absurd to talk about extending the shuttle. The factory's been shut down. They don't have any new external tanks. It's not going to happen. And so we should stop living fantasy world and think about what's going to happen next. And so the shuttle is irrelevant to the matter. And the shuttle, already they've taken, Enterprise, gosh, the shuttle that launched
Endeavor.
They've already taken Endeavor apart.
Yeah.
And Discovery just came back, and they're taking it apart for its shipment to a museum. These are not going to fly again. And it's silly to even discuss it in that way. It's just distracting. To my mind, at this stage in the game, it's not being mature about the realities of our problem. Well, a lot of the anger and partisanship you see in the space community is the result of a lot of justifiable pain and disappointment, because we are now faced in a situation where the United States does not have the capability of getting people into space. And we don't have any clear path to getting that back.
Okay, Bob. Four flights in 2008 and five in 2009.
Say again?
Four flights in 2008.
Yeah.
five in 2009.
Okay.
And I think the biggest number of flights, if my memory is right, and it may not be right, was nine flights. Or
that was 1983
or 84, something like that.
Yeah, but that I can tell for a fact.
And I think that's the most number that they ever did in 1 year.
Yeah. And five flights, I think, is probably the high since the Cat Challenger accident. And I'm speaking
Yeah, there are a couple of years. Well, 1 year they did six.
But the thing is, their average flight rate has always been less.
Okay, here's some more questions for you. Jack in Virginia. Does the schizophrenic nature of the Obama administration with regard to the conservative approach to NASA make Richard Shelby a liberal big government guy with with regard to NASA? Just asking.
That's a great question from Jack, and I have to say that Richard Shelby has never been and is not a conservative from my perspective of what a conservative is, a small government conservative. He's a typical Republican get-along guy who uses government like a lot of the so-called rhinos in Congress. They're not really conservatives, and he doesn't really believe in it. He likes to manipulate and spend pork dollars for his district. That's where he's coming from day one. So does that make him a liberal? It makes him surely not a small government guy. He's facing serious primary challenges because the Republicans in his state have recognized that he's not giving them what they really want. And so, yeah, there's a lot of schizophrenia when it comes to this issue, and it's part of the problem the nation has with its budget. I said this on Bachelor and got into a big fight with John Bachelor because he likes space no matter what, and he would like them to spend money on space no matter what. And I said, with our deficit it is now, I am not going to be one of those people that says, cut everything, but not my program. My program is precious. No, I think space is important. But I personally think at this moment in time, the needs of the nation call for a willingness to cut more, even programs I like. And I personally think cutting NASA and cutting the federal budget will not hurt space in the long run. It'll help it. Because I don't think government has achieved what we wanted over the decades.
Kelly sent an email, and I'm asking him to clarify it. By email, because I don't really understand what he's saying. But I'll read it, and you may just want to defer and see if he calls in, because I've asked him to call in. But he says the House used the current yearly program. You know, I don't even know that.
I know what he's talking about. I understand what he's talking about. They used the current NASA operations budget for the shuttle. And though the last two, 3 years, maybe 4 years, those budget numbers have been less than $4 billion a year. They've ranged between $3 and $4 billion, closer to $3 than to $4. He's absolutely right in that. My point in that, in the last 3 to 5 years, they're shutting the program down, so costs are going down. They don't have the same kind of development costs they had before. They've been laying people off for the last 3 years in this program, step by step. I mean, I know what he's referring to. He's not wrong, but that's not the realistic shuttle operations budget. If you have an ongoing shuttle program, it's going to cost you $4 billion a year on that.
Okay, so what I was going to say before you didn't let me say what I was going to say is that I don't even know. Yeah, you talk too loud and you don't listen. But I don't even know that the listeners know what the heck we're talking about here, because this is pretty esoteric.
Yeah.
So, listeners, if this subject does interest you, as Bob said, there was a hearing before the House subcommittee on, science and technology?
Yeah.
Not last week, but the week before last.
Yeah.
They were saying a couple of things. They did an analysis of the cost of various ways to get people to space, to get cargo to space.
Pounds
to space. It was dry mass cargo, which means excluding fuel. And they listed the cost of various different platforms or rockets that could do it. And then they listed the cost for the COTS program, commercial providers. And based upon the contract price that they have agreed to with 80 tons by whatever the date was, I think 2015 or 2016, divided between SpaceX and Orbital. And they agreed to pay, what, $3.5 billion or something for that. They did not count any excess capacity, which SpaceX says they have available and claims that that would lower the cost. And in the analysis of all of this, the commercials came up at a higher cost per pound than all the other systems, including Shuttle.
Yeah.
So now, this appeared on Marcia Smith's Space Policy Online, had the most factual, I mean, it was just the information about what was in the House.
Yeah.
And then you can go to their website, the House website, and you can pull down the testimony.
You can go to the article on Behind the Black Hole, Cost of Space Cargo. I've got not only a link to the House report, but I've got a screen capture of the key table from that report that describes this.
Right, and you can go to their House website and read the testimony of the I don't know if they've got the videos up of it yet or not. So that's what we're talking about. So most of the testimony was that we're in this for a really long haul, and if it's more costly now, it's not going to be more costly over time as the public-private partnership with NASA kicks in and develops, and we're able to get this going, and we're seeding, a new industry, much the way other industries have been seeded and developed up front by the government, who buys down the risk and picks up, extraordinary cost. And ultimately, this is going to pay off. But some of the things that caught my attention in this was the testimony by the head of the committee said that NASA cannot allow the privates to fail because there aren't any other options anymore. So obviously they're going to do what it takes to get them to be successful, whether they're the high-cost guy on the block or the low-cost on the block. And one thing to note, I think, is, and Bob has talked about this a lot on the space show, NASA never had as a goal to have low-cost access to space.
The original shuttle program, David,
well, that got modified.
That
yeah, but then it changed, and that was never
right.
never the issues have always been reliability and safety and
right.
If you can call this a routine schedule, some sort of a routine capability out of it. But being low cost was never part of it. And when I've interviewed people with Atlas and Delta and Ariane, they tell me that the pricing is just a small factor of the launch cost part of the pricing is only a small part of what concerns commercial customers when they're buying a launch for their satellites or whatever they may be doing. And they're not as focused on the actual launch price per pound as they are on reliability and frequency and routine and things like that.
To a certain extent, that's true. But if someone can come along and show that they can do it significantly cheaper and reliably at the same time, they're going to get customers.
Yeah, but they would.
And SpaceX is getting customers.
They say, the adage would be "show me,"
right.
And they I don't think they'd take very many words for it. I think they'd want to see a number of flights and
right.
and validation.
Right.
Like any normal person
right.
would want.
Right.
Would
I mean, and that's absolutely the case. And for a lot of space companies, they're absolutely not going to buy a product just because it's cheaper. It's got to be something that will get to orbit
and be reliable and routine and all
yeah.
of that. Yeah.
But now, in terms of in terms of this whole House hearing and this so-called.
And by the way, nothing came out of it, as far as I know, right?
No, it was all junk. It was trying to once again sell the. It's part of the political game going on here by a lot of congressmen to try to sell the government-built program, formerly called Constellation, the heavy lift rocket. They're trying to convince both other congressmen and senators, as well as the public, that the money should go to that and not commercial space. And you've got a turf war going on here. That's really what's
going
on.
Well, that's why I said it.
And you've got people in NASA whose livelihoods are dependent on the shuttle program and a government-run rocket system. And they're seeing an end to that, and so they're trying to protect their turf as well. And they will feed information to Congress accordingly. I don't question the money, the numbers they came up with for the COTS and for even the crew development programs. I don't really question those numbers. They're probably reasonable because the numbers here are pretty straightforward. They had a contract and they just divided it by the number of flights and the poundages and you come up with a number. And I think it's actually a reasonable estimate of the number. The numbers that came up for the shuttle, though, are just bogus. And they have very clearly been massaged to make it look like it's a cheaper system, and we should have kept that system.
Well, maybe Kelly will call in and dispute you.
Well, sure.
On air.
Yeah,
Kelly, you got to see the I envy you on this. You did see the last Discovery flight.
Yes, I did.
I've only been fortunate enough to see one shuttle flight, in all the history of all of this, and at least I'm fortunate enough to have seen one. Tell us about about seeing Discovery. Where did you see it from?
Well, I had never seen an actual large launch, a big shuttle launch or Apollo Saturn V launch. I had seen back in 81, this is my previous career, I was in the movie business, and I was working on a really bad horror film, which has never seen the light of day anywhere, and I don't care. I was a key grip on that. I was the guy that ran the dollies. But one of the shots, we were shooting this down in Florida, and we were in this cheap motel that was right on the beach that overlooked towards Kennedy, and one of our shots included a rocket takeoff at night. And it was like, I think, a Delta II. It was a smaller rocket. And that was kind of cool. But I'd never actually seen a shuttle launch. And when a friend of mine said, we're going down, I said, well, I'm going to go with you. And so we drove down. And to Florida, it's about a 12-hour drive, and we went to a place called Space Park in Titusville. It's one of the small town that basically looks, it's one of the closest public spots you can get. It's about 11 miles away from the launch pad, but you do have a good view, clear view of the launch pad. And we basically got there at about 8 o'clock at night, the evening before the launch, 12 hours before, with chairs and some stuff, food. And we sat down. We were already second in line. The first row of seats, space right at the water line, were already filled. And we were in the second row, and we sat there and hung out. It was a very nice collegiate atmosphere. I don't know, David, when you saw your launch, were you in the press area up close?
No, Jack, who just emailed us a few minutes ago, got VIP passes for Rita Anderson and myself, and we were in the VIP section, which is 3 miles away.
Yeah.
If I had it to do over again, I wouldn't be in the VIP section, and I won't get it to do over again because the damn thing's ending, but I would go in the press section.
Jack, what was wrong with the VIP section?
Nothing. I just think I would have been more comfortable, and I would have been with a lot sharper people.
Oh, I see.
So here's what happens in the VIP. It's actually very, very cool. So you have a great view. You got a big, huge flat screen countdown clock.
You're only about 3 miles away.
Well, they're both 3 miles away.
Right.
The media, but they're from a different perspective.
Right.
And you can see both of the shuttle things across the water there.
Right.
And then the Kennedy Center that has the Saturn V exhibit is within running distance. Now, the reason I say it's within running distance, because they announced several times over the intercom that if they give the word, meaning the shuttle has blown up, you've got about 3 minutes before this toxic cloud of who the hell knows what's in it is going to hit the VIP section. So you are directed when the word goes to run as fast as you can to be sealed into the building with the Saturn V to protect you, or to get into one of the many, many, many tour buses that have taken the VIP crowds from this big parking lot an hour away, and the buses will seal the doors and protect you and get you out of there. So that's why I'm just saying it's really within running distance of the Saturn V. Well, fortunately, that didn't happen. So as we're getting pretty close to the countdown, and there's a lot of people in there. You get your tickets from your senator, your member of the House of Representatives. So that's what the VIP means. It doesn't mean that you're really anybody special. It just means you've gotten on a lot of tickets from your congressional delegation. Well, no, they're available to the public. And
you still are pulling strings, even though you're asking for a favor, you get it. That's
well, yeah, they have so many tickets to give away, and they're first come, first serve. Right. Unless you're a really big name, like, say, Donald Trump, they'll make sure you get tickets no matter what, right?
Right.
Okay, so you know, you're in there with everybody, and you're sitting in bleachers, and there's a lot of cameras on tripods set up in the grassy knoll in front, you know, to see it all. And then right before the main engines start, they play the national anthem, and everybody stands up. I'm telling you, this is a very holy spiritual ritual experience.
That was very different from my experience.
It is. You know, everyone will probably think I'm being really hokey about it. It is really solemn, and if you have never felt the pride that comes from the American flag and our space program, being in the VIP section, you cannot miss that feeling. I mean, this is, you understand how special this is at that moment in time for the United States to be able to do this and for our tax dollars to have made this work and for these really brave people to be on it and to doing this, you know, in the name of the U.S. and humanity. I'm telling you, even if you're the most cynical bastard, you're not going to come away from this experience without deep reflection and feeling. And then main engines light and you're getting it on closed circuit TV. A few, you know, maybe a half a second and a half later, you get hit with the vibrations and the thunder and the sound of the engines. And we saw a night launch, and we saw it all the way to orbit. It was that
clear
a night. We could track it with our naked eyes all the way to orbit. It was just, it was unbelievable. And thank Jack for making that possible for Rita and myself to go down there. And listeners, if you can get down to see Atlantis somehow, even if you park along the side of the road, it's
gonna
be
a lot of people there, David.
Yeah, it's the last shuttle flight. I say go do it. Don't miss out on it. You'll never see anything like it.
Yours, because being 11 miles away, I expected everybody you always read about describes the experience has always seen it from those 3 mile distances, the VIP area or the press area. So I expected to hear the rumble in my bones, you know, as they say. But I was at a more public area 11 miles away, and it was quite spectacular to see, but it was much more distant. So by the time that rolling sound reached us, it was like a faint thunder, and I mean a faint thunder. So it was, in a sense, almost disappointing. Having said that, I would never have traded the opportunity to have seen it, David, because there's several things about this experience were different than yours. It wasn't so solemn. It was a crowd of people who were passionately interested in space and wanted to see something they know represents the future of the human race, regardless of whether it's the shuttle or Ares or SpaceX. It's still, every rocket launch like this with humans on it is representing the future. And everyone there was passionately interested in this. So I was a bunch of, they weren't, you know, I'm sure it's in this sense similar where you were, but it was much more of a casual.
Well, see, we're organized.
A tailgate party is the kind of thing.
Yeah, we're organized by NASA. You know,
right.
There are
no organization at all.
Yeah.
Where I was. It was just, so it was very spontaneous. But it was spontaneous, but unified to a fault. Everyone there knew why they were there, and for the same reasons, because they were looking at the future, and they wanted to see it, and they wanted to see a really cool thing that represented the future, because it's exciting to watch. And that, to me, was an experience different and worthwhile and not written about very much. You know, most of the time people talk about the power of the shuttle launch itself, and what I actually saw was the power of humans' faith in the future by the people that were just there to see it.
I can tell you, everyone really loved the shuttle program.
You were, or just in general?
No, in general there. And you know, it was already planned on being, you know, retired and everything. And already, you know, people were upset about it. They didn't want it retired. They're missing it. You know, the people who came there and that were in that VIP gallery were very, very committed to wanting this space program to be
ongoing.
That's
different. I'll tell you, that's different from where I was, because where you were, I have a feeling, because maybe it's the nature of the VIP place, the kind of people that are there. But where I was, I mean, people wanted space exploration, but there was a lot more mixed feelings about whether the shuttle itself was
well,
the greatest thing.
Keep in mind, you know, we were before Obamacare, the budget crises, you know, the problems with the deficit. There was a huge debate about the shuttle that a lot of people paid attention to. That was all after our experience. So, you know, when we went down there, it was still mom and apple pie and footsteps, remember. We're dealing more or less in the old world before the new world and Obama space changed everything.
What year did you go?
I guess it would have been 08. I don't even remember the flight. Jack, if you're listening, was it Shuttle Flight 137? I don't remember which one we were on, but I mean, we saw, but it was way in advance. Mike was still the administrator direct 2.0 was still fighting about the Constellation plan, you know, that debate that was going on
before the election.
I think maybe the election had been held, but we were still in at the end of 2008. Maybe if Jack is still listening, he'll clarify. He's younger than I am and probably remembers. what can I say? But, you know, it's if you go to the VIP section, it's very organized by NASA, and you've got astronauts that were there to answer questions and people that work for NASA that could answer questions. We had time to do the tour of the Saturn V and in the hangar. It's laying down and spread apart
right,
so you can see it all. And I would really urge people to do that. And it was a lot of fun. It was fun. It was really almost like a religious experience.
Okay. We've been on an hour. Can we take a break?
Yeah, we'll take a break, and maybe Jack will email me with which flight we were on. Listeners, we'll be back in 3 minutes with Bob Zimmerman. Let's talk about going to Mars and what you think about Zubrin's plan and what you think about Harrison Schmitt's plan to get rid of NASA. So
okay.
Back in 3 minutes.
Okay.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. We're doing the Space Show today on D-Day, Monday, June 6th, and our guest is Bob Zimmerman. And Jack did just reply, and we saw the STS-126 night launch, and this was just after the election when President Obama had won the election. So none of the space policy talks or anything like that were going on, the public was, if they were paying attention at all, it was really about constellation, and maybe if they knew anything, it was about direct, saying they could do it better, if you recall, than constellation.
Right.
Mike was still the administrator of NASA, and so it, I don't think it's possible to compare the audience, for example, yeah, back then to, say, what people know and are aware of today. And we did see Endeavor. So, and Endeavor, of course, is what just quit flying, right? So, listeners, you can call and talk to Bob, and our programs do work better with the phone instead of email, 1-866-687-7223. So let me fast forward to the ISDC conference a couple of weeks ago in Huntsville, and Bob Zubrin gave a talk about how to go to Mars in 10 years using Falcon Heavy and the Dragon capsule. And really, it's kind of a government program to do this, more so than the private industry funding it on its own, but it's clearly making use of the commercials with SpaceX's Dragon and SpaceX's Falcon Heavy, which is planned but not yet built. And he's been getting an enormous amount of press about this.
Yeah.
And, in fact, he's coming on the show at the end of June to talk more about it. And Bob really believes we can do humans with two missions. Yeah, but he said two of the right-minded people, because obviously being in a Dragon is not going to be the most comfortable experience possible to go to Mars.
500 days flight minimum.
You think there's any meat to this? Do you think there's any chance something like this would, assuming you can do all the technical stuff to make it happen?
Well, that assumption is the premise that I get annoyed at right off the start.
Well, of course, but you have to zero that out.
We have to start right there. Engineering right now, they do not have the capability of building a ship that people can live on for 500 plus days.
Of course,
back and forth from Mars. We do not have the capability. Not on a long-distance flight 100 million miles away from Earth. We don't have the capability.
Well, here's what I say about this, and 'cause I know Bob dismisses human factors and the issue of putting big payloads on Mars and a lot of issues. But the thing that Bob does, well, first of all, he's very, very inspiring to hear talk. He's among the best I've ever heard on any topic in my life. And but he puts it on a schedule. Whether that schedule is going to slip or not is not so important to me. But you can't really start working the problem and meeting these challenges like you just mentioned until you know that you're supposed to go to Mars in 10 years from now. And the way it is now, it's so nebulous and vague. Maybe we'll fly by Mars in 2030.
David?
Yeah.
No, putting a date on it doesn't work either.
You don't think that works
putting
either?
Putting a date on something that's not, without really facing the real problems that need to be addressed, doesn't work. Look, everyone keeps copying Kennedy putting a date on getting to the moon. Reagan said, we'll build a space station by 1990. We did not. George Bush said, we're going to go back to the moon by such and such a date. It had no relevance at all in getting the job done. Obama now is saying we're going to be the asteroids in 2025, I think is the date.
Something
give me a break.
Like it, yeah.
It's totally unrealistic.
So what works?
Reality. The idea that Zubrin's proposing, all well and good, but I'm glad there are people who want to think forward like this, but we have to think about the realities of what needs to be done to do this. And the problem with his proposal is it sidesteps completely learning the realities of how to do this. By trying to create a stunt flight that will just get us to Mars and back and put a few footprints and a flag down, not only do you not focus on the problem that has to be solved to learn how to put people that far, but you don't create a situation where you'll do it again. And the more important thing is solving the problems. The Russians are continuing to do this. They're focused on solving these problems. By putting our minds only in these stunts that have no basis in reality, we're not focused on what the problems are. The problems are this. You have to have a ship that can keep a crew alive comfortably for more than almost 2 years. You have to have a ship that far from home can be maintained and repaired by the tools and supplies on hand. You have to have a ship that can have a reasonably closed atmosphere and water system so that it doesn't have to carry tons of supplies. That's the ship alone. You have to have a ship that's designed to protect the crew from radiation. It's a design issue that has to be dealt. If you don't include artificial gravity, then you have to solve the problem of how to keep people, bones and muscles, working sufficiently so that when they get to Mars, they can actually function. And we do not know yet how to do that. Astronauts that are up in space for a year, come back to Earth, do not function on their own. Cannot. They cannot get out of the Soyuz capsule on their own. So these are basic problems that have to be solved. Now, if you add artificial gravity, and I just was looking at a webpage where this was asked of Bob, and he said, oh, we'll just add it. Just do put in artificial gravity, and you don't have the medical problem.
Yeah, he blows it off.
That's a technical engineering problem that we're not even started to address yet. There's never even been a centrifuge up in orbit. The only time it was ever attempted was on Soyuz 18 back in, like, 70, in which there was an 18-day mission in a Soyuz capsule, and the Russians spun it, I think, to create an artificial gravity, and the crew came, it was such a small object, that it destroyed their balancing systems. They came down to Earth in worse shape than anyone else had ever done. That doesn't mean this can't be solved. It just means let's address the real problems involved. So saying we're going to go to Mars with three Falcon Heavy launches is, that might, you know, on a very simple level, absolutely you've got the tonnage, you can put up a lot of stuff. But what is the shape of the tonnage you're putting into orbit and then sending to Mars? From an engineer's perspective, we really have yet no idea because we haven't built any of the modules and spaceships that can travel to Mars and back safely.
So why do you think a learned and legitimate engineer scientist proposes this and blows off all the stuff that we're talking
about? Well, look, he's a visionary. He wants to be visionary, and he's pushing an idea for the sake of exploring colonizing the solar system. All ideas I agree with, you know. Visionary things are a good thing. But it does distract us. It's one of the reasons, for example, the space station, ISS, is not accomplishing what we need it to accomplish, which is to teach us how to build these kind of spaceships. Because we didn't stay focused on the purpose of why you build such a thing. And the Russians have. Everything they do on ISS and they did on Mir was trying to figure out how to build a interplanetary spaceship.
So you
they
say
focus on that.
So going to Mars this way is DOA, is what you're
saying. First of all, I don't think the funds are there. Realistically, let's talk about the funding. It's not there.
I don't see it either.
No, it's just not there. So that's the first thing. And he's trying to drum up funding, but it's just not realistic. Secondly, it's not practical from an engineering perspective. It won't happen because we don't know how to do it yet. Wernher von Braun, very wisely, he proposed something almost identical to this himself, just variations, you know, with different knowledge
right.
In the 1950s. But his Mars project was a variation on Zubrin's. It was very visionary. It was how, engineering-wise, you could do this with what I know right now. But Wernher von Braun, in 1954, admitted then that this is a pipe dream. That it's going to be at least, and this is his words, it's going to be at least a century or more before we get to Mars. That was his words, because he recognized that in order to get to Mars, it's going to take time to figure out how to live in space and build in space and function in space, engineering-wise, for those long periods of travel time.
So here's
and he made that prediction in 1954. We're now 55 years later, and I think his timeline is still 100% accurate. We're still 50 years away.
Paul in Denver sent in a note and says, so what do you suggest we do in order to make a Mars human mission possible?
We need a robust space industry functioning in a variety of ways. You need to learn how to build your space interplanetary ships in orbit. That's what a space station can teach you. You can tie that to a lunar base where it's close to Earth and you can learn how to build a base on another planet because that's a different engineering problem. Those are the exploratory questions from an engineering perspective that have to be addressed. You build a base on the moon, and you have a space station in orbit, which is your testing your interplanetary spaceships. For example, ISS. Well, we should have a two-year mission on ISS. A crew goes up for 2 years. We should do it and learn the consequences of a two-year mission. Now, maybe we'd have to build towards a two-year mission because there are medical issues, but we should be building towards that. That would be one of the things towards building, getting to a point where we can travel to Mars. But to me, first and foremost, even before those particular engineering proposals I just put out, even before that, we have got to have a true, profitable space industry that can get us into orbit reasonably cheap and have competition to continually reduce the cost. If we have that, then everything else will follow naturally. If we don't have that, we can't have anything at that point, you know? It's like, David, and I said this on the air, but I'll say it again. I'm doing this coast-to-coast interview. This is the period of time after the Columbia accident. We don't have any way to get anybody in orbit, and they haven't yet fixed the shuttle to fly it again. Right. And I had people calling and asking me about terraforming Mars. I mean, we couldn't even get people in orbit yet, and we were talking about terraforming Mars. Well, let's talk about getting into orbit in an efficient, creative manner with multiple options that are competing and innovating so that you get better rockets and spaceships. And then we'll start to have an industry in space that can function and start to test the engineering that's needed to take us farther. That's where I come from.
So if we had a near, and we've got a caller on hold for you, but if we had a near ideal environment for space development, give us a timeline in which you think we could, if we were really working the problems, and that would be part of that ideal environment, to where we would evolve enough to really be seriously putting on the books a human footprints on the moon.
I go back to what Wernher von Braun's prediction in 1954, I think is still right on the line. Based on how history is evolving and how the development in space is evolving, it takes time. For one thing, to be able to fly a two-year-long mission to Mars, you're going to have a period of time when people are actually doing two-year-long missions.
Yeah, to see if they can do it.
That's right. And so that's going to take time to do. That could take, can't do it just once. You're probably going to have to do it several times, build up to a two-year mission in space. So that's several years of that.
So you're talking 40 to 60 years at a minimum.
I am. Wernher von Braun predicted it's going to be 100 years in 55 years ago, and I still think he's right. So it's at least 40, 50 years into the future.
And that's if we're actually in an environment that is conducive to doing all of this.
Granted. I mean, if the economy goes kaput and the government goes kaput, that's going to delay this even more.
Right.
But assuming that the society is still a functioning society as it's been for, 1,000 years or so, Western civilization. I think that 40, 50 years down the road, this is going to happen. And I think, actually, how space has been evolving over the last 40 years, it's evolving in exactly that timeline. Because we're beginning to see now, 50 years after the beginning of the space age, you're beginning to see now new companies competing for the right to sell product to get into space. And they're developing that's the beginnings of a robust industry, a true industry, not a something living off the tax dollar.
See, so we may have had unrealistic expectations 20 years out from Apollo or something.
If we had, there's a talk I give about the CompSat Act back in 1963,
uh-huh.
In which I describe how our expectations were not unrealistic, but we went about trying to get into space in the wrong way and squelched our own possibilities. This is what I talk about all the time. I mean, freedom would have been AT&T was ready to launch a constellation of satellites, 20 to 50 satellites in 1963, the Telstar constellation, to provide worldwide communications capability to replace intercontinental, transatlantic, and transpacific telephone cables, which were not very efficient and very expensive. They wanted to put up satellites to replace those cables. And it would have required anywhere from 40 to 60 launches a year to do this. And they were prepared to do the money. Had they had that system allowed to have been, they had been allowed to proceed with that system, they would have been a private customer for launch services. we would have started to see the kind of launch rocket development we see now happen then. But,
well, but
Kennedy chose instead to go with CompSat, a government-imposed communication system that put up geosynchronous satellites using IntelSat and squelched AT&T's system.
Well, there were technical reasons, too, and it was also with Hughes and Syncon. And
the point I'm getting at is that the government stepped in and dictated how the communications industry was going to be run.
Well, it was all government.
And because
then,
of that, there was no longer a need. If AT&T was incorrect and technically it wasn't going to work, then it would have failed. But in the process, they still would have had 40 to 60 launches, which would have helped feed a launch industry.
Well, Iridium,
and the Freedom would have actually got us an industry here. We didn't get it. So, in a sense, we have been overly optimistic about our potential, but in the other sense, we've helped squelch it, David. That's to answer your question, in my opinion.
Let's see who our caller is. Caller, are you with us, please?
I am.
And you are, please?
Tim from Huntsville. How's my reception?
So far, so good, Tim.
Excellent.
Go for it.
Okay. Yeah, I have to take issue with that timeline. I'll tell you why. I know everyone says, don't look at Apollo. Apollo's gone. Apollo's no more. But I'm looking at what we went from originally. No capability of launching a man in the space starting in 1960 to landing them on the moon. We started with the Saturn V rocket, started designing and building it on 1962, came up with it in 1966. I don't doubt it's hard to go to Mars, but I think it's way overstating to say it's going to take 100 years. I would wager that it would take 10 years once people actually want to go to Mars.
Well, Tim, first of all, I'm not saying 100 years from today. I'm saying 100 years from 1954. That's when Wernher von Braun made the prediction, which says that if from today's date, about 45 years into the future, we will have the capability of doing it. So that's the first thing. So you understand. I'm not saying it's 100 years from today. Secondly, once again, you're putting human beings in a weightless environment for a period of 2 years. And we're not going to get any, at this point in time, realistic volunteers to do that. In fact, it's dangerous to send anyone, not because I'm afraid they'll die, but because they won't.
Hold on, one at a time, guys.
Let me just finish the point. When they get to Mars after a year in space, they will not be able to function on the surface. We're not even sure. They will not be able to function on the surface because their bones and muscle capabilities will have declined. This is a known fact from space, from long-term missions on both Mir and ISS. And that is a technical problem and a medical problem that can only be solved by flying long missions in Earth orbit. And that takes time to do. You can't get away from the fact that you have to run a two-year orbital mission to learn how to survive in space for 2 years before you can actually do a two-year mission to Mars itself. So even if we would have a 100% commitment today, NASA was going to get a $50 billion budget to go to Mars, it still is going to take a decade of research before we even beginning to get close to being able to fly the mission. That's where I'm coming from on this, and I don't think people recognize the challenges here very clearly. I wrote about this at length in Leaving Earth because I saw the difficulties involved.
All right, now you said it'd take at least a decade of research. Well, some of that research would include trying to find ways to produce engineering a ship to produce artificial gravity. At that point, it's a moot point to even consider prolong states in microgravity.
I think you're being very nonchalant about the engineering challenges of building a spaceship in orbit right now that has artificial gravity. You have to get the mass up into orbit. We don't have the capability or the resources to launch that much mass for building such a thing, and then it's got to function in orbit, and it hasn't been tested. We've never even built such a thing. We have, you know, the wheels in space. Wernher von Braun proposed it back in the 50s, but nothing's been built along those lines. Nothing has even been tested. No engineering work has actually been done. NASA abandoned the wheel in space almost from day one, 50 years ago, because they realized, in terms of engineering, they just don't have the capability yet. we might have had been able to do such a thing, and this is where, in a sense, I'm not disagreeing with you, we might have been able to do something like this when we had the Saturn V, if we had been willing to commit the funds. Because you could have sent up a lot of, each Skylab module could have been linked together and produced a very large wheel. You could have actually maybe been able to get it done. But then what spins it? And how does, I've seen the difficulties the Russians had with Mir in terms of trying to figure out how to deal with these subtle engineering issues that the devil's in those details, and those subtle engineering issues caused them no ends of challenges that they solved one by one, but they did it over the 15-year life of Mir. And ISS now has been up for about 13 years, and some of those challenges have been addressed on ISS, but not as much because the focus on ISS has not been in the same place.
Hey, Tim, did I
wipe you out, Tim? Or I'm sorry. I just
Tim, did you hear the classroom show on artificial gravity with Joe Carroll?
I didn't get a chance to hear it.
All right, so here's your assignment. Not only listen to that program, but go through the presentation material that Joe put up on the Space Show Classroom blog. Remember, the classroom has its own blog. Because, I don't know that we want to get into it today, but this whole issue of artificial gravity, what gravity is required for humans, they're leaching calcium at 1% a month. Okay,
in
space. Well, I'm just rounding it off.
Okay.
And then your muscles are atrophying, and until there is a variable gravity research station of some kind in space, it's not gonna. We're not doing anything long duration in space. Bone rest studies don't cut it. Whether it's a two-year mission kind of thing like Bob is talking about or something like Joe Carroll is talking about, until we get serious about all of this stuff, humans aren't going into long-duration space flight.
Yeah, what I want to emphasize here is I firmly believe this is going to happen, and I honestly am in favor of it happening. But I think that by focusing on trying to do a leap out there, leap across the gap between two 40-story buildings, this is not the Matrix. You can't make the leap. You got to figure out how to get across. And I think we're not focusing on Earth orbit research to learn how to do that. Specifically, build the ship in Earth orbit. Build it. See the space station as your prototype interplanetary spaceship, as self-sufficient as it must be, and as repairable in orbit by the men on board as can be. Not having mission control tweak things from the ground, which is what we do on ISS. The Chinese are approaching this. The Chinese might get there much sooner than anyone believes as they slowly, incrementally develop their space station, build modules bit by bit, and they're copying the Russian Salyut modules. And by doing that, they're thinking in terms of an interplanetary spaceship. Once they get something assembled in orbit, you require years of research to make sure it functions in space for years. And then you can take the next step and consider getting it to Mars. Think about that. I've only described the ship that would get you to Mars orbit and back. It's not a lander. And that's the whole different game of going to, let's say, a lunar base and learning how to have a functioning base where you can go up and down and have facilities on the ground to live on. That's a different problem entirely.
Okay.
I just wish we wouldn't take these issues so lightly. They're not simple things.
Well, I'm not trying to take them lightly at all. Okay. Here's the thing, though. I mean, if you lived in 1960 and someone told you in 7 years we're going to have a vehicle that can lift 100 tons into low Earth orbit, 120 tons to low Earth orbit, would you say that person was being flippant because he was telling you that's how we're going to go to the moon?
No. I lived at the time, and I would say, yep, we're going to do it. I had no doubt about doing it. Getting a crew of two men to land on the moon and back is a whole order of magnitude simpler engineering problem than going to Mars and back. I'm not saying it can't be done. In fact, think about it. You said we could do it in 10 years, and I'm saying at this moment in time it's going to happen in around 45 years. We're not that far apart when you think about it. But I think it's going to take us longer than four decades if we don't start focusing on the actual problems involved.
45 years.
Thinking we can leap out there like Apollo. Apollo's a different. It's a totally different order of magnitude, a different engineering problem than going to Mars.
Well, here's the thing: 45 years is the difference between seeing it within your lifetime and probably not seeing it in your lifetime.
You're right, Tim. I mean, what I'm saying to you means I almost certainly will not see it at my age right now. Absolutely the case. But I'm a historian. I watch how trends and long-term society evolution occurs. This is what I write about. And I've just seen how long it takes things to get done. Think about the American settlement of this continent. Columbus discovered the New World in 1492, say 1500 to make the math easy. The United States, the first colony in North America, didn't occur for more than 100 years later. Why did it take so long, 100 years? And then 1607 is when Jamestown was established, and the Pilgrims came in 1620. You don't get the United States for another 140 years. That's a long time. And we today don't concede how long the time was.
Well, England was sort of late going into the exploration game. I know Spain, they were, I know, from the time Columbus landed in the New World to Cortez conquering Mexico and starting a colony in Mexico was about 30 years.
Yes, in that case, the Spaniards in the tropical climates of South America and Central America and Mexico were able to move in and establish their colonies and their colonies again relatively quick, within 30, 40 years. But also, think about that a minute. They had the ships already that were able to travel long distances over the oceans. The ships already existed when they discovered the New World. They didn't have to bring oxygen and water and food with them. They could live off the land. These are problems much more challenging in deep space.
Well, Mars,
once again, I'm not talking.
I know Mars would be able to live off land as well.
We can do it.
Hey, Tim,
yeah.
You're on a cell phone, so you don't have full duplex. So you got to pay attention, or everyone's going to talk over you. This is a cell phone problem.
It's
one of the reasons I don't like them. They're not full duplex, and Bob and I are on a real phone line. So that's why you're talking over each other. So you got to pay attention to do one at a time. Or you could do over, you know, like an old-fashioned Mars shortwave call. Hello, over, and then you talk.
Well, I'm over, so it's your turn, Tim. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Tim.
There is, which one, me or?
No, Tim, you're talking now.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to say this. I do agree with him with Bob on one thing. Is that it may be 100 years, but not because it's so technologically, it's not such a hard, such a technological hurdle as much as just people just aren't interested. I believe that we'll go to Mars in about 10, 15 years, give some fudge room when we actually want to go to Mars. That's my opinion.
Okay, let me interject, okay? Because these are the issues in summary form that need to be resolved before we do any long-duration space flight, let alone go to Mars. So number one is you have a real serious issue with microgravity, which includes muscle deterioration and atrophy and the leaching of calcium and bone loss. Number two, as you go to 4 months and longer, as we learned from Mir, your mental condition deteriorates dramatically. And as you leave Earth and you don't see Earth, it's even a bigger mental breakdown and a psychotic experience. And as you go further and further out and the communication times start coming into delay, this entire mental breakdown process is even more severe. There is absolutely nothing close today to a closed loop life support system, which is needed in going to Mars. There is nothing today in terms of radiation shielding. And if you wanted to use water, you would have no mass, given the kinds of propulsions we have, that would be able to take anything with you to Mars. So you need some kind of radiation shielding other than something that weighs a hell of a lot of weight. And then the largest thing we have ever landed on Mars is Viking. And Zubrin talks about 20,000-pound payloads on Mars. And Viking was about 2,100 pounds. And because of problems with the Martian atmosphere and a lot of other issues, we don't have a technology today that can land a heavy payload on Mars. Now, these are the issues that are just in very short summary form. Prescription drugs don't work well in space, and they deteriorate with radiation and over time. There is no way to treat a human for a heart attack or for any kind of surgery and do blood containment in microgravity on a long-duration flight to Mars. They've even thought about we should remove appendixes and other things that are not needed prophylactically from crews that would do this kind of a mission. There, you know, the medical issues and the things that Bob has been talking about and others are really dramatic. They're not showstoppers, but they need solutions. So the question before you is, you can't just throw money at a lot of this stuff and get an answer, because some of it is an evolutionary nature in development, and some of it comes about, you know, honest to God, out of serendipity. So there has to be a period of concerted time in research and investment and methodical working of these problems. And I would really contend that even if you were well-funded, and even if you already had a variable gravity research station up in LEO, that you could not solve these human factors problems in a 10-year time period from today.
I want to interject here that I think the list of problems you just outlined are probably not as serious. Some of them I don't consider to be serious problems, like the psychological issues of long-term.
Well, you ought to see what happened. I should put you in touch with Vadim Regalov, who kept the mere astronauts from going insane.
I've spoken to a lot of those people.
Well, have you spoken to them?
No, they.
Well, we're going to disagree on this.
I'm not trying to dismiss it. I think that all these things can be solved, but it's going to take time to solve them. And actually, I don't think any government program is ever going to solve them.
Well, I agree.
I think it's going to require a robust, actually profitable industry in space with people up there doing work, who will then have a motive to solve the problems themselves. And that's the long-term process. And I think it's going to happen over the next 40, 50 years. But it's not going to happen tomorrow, and it's not going to happen, as Zubrin thinks, over the next decade.
Jack sent in a question for both of you. Elon at SpaceX says he can be at Mars in a decade, 15 to 20 years in worst case. You don't share Elon's enthusiasm.
Absolutely not. It comes back to the same thing. I think Elon Musk is being very naive about the engineering and medical challenges involved for getting humans to Mars and back safely. I don't doubt the capability of the Falcon Heavy, once built, of putting enough tonnage up into orbit, several launches, as Zubrin suggests, to accumulate the modules in orbit that could then go to Mars. But I question seriously the reality of being able to launch and actually build those modules in a workable form that will work in Mars orbit. I mean, I really like to emphasize the repairability issue, which people just always go right past. If you're in Mars orbit 100 million miles away and your toilet breaks, now that sounds funny, but it's a serious medical and engineering problem that could kill the crew. And we've had ISS toilets break on the American side, and they used the shuttle to ship up a replacement. Can't do that in Mars.
Can't do that anymore. We don't have the capacity.
Yeah, that's a good point. But in Mars orbit, you definitely couldn't do it. The Russians' toilet breaks, they designed it from their experience on Mir. They designed it so that the spare parts are relatively easy, available on the station, and even if the spare parts aren't there, it's easy to take apart by the crew on hand with the tools on hand, and they can take it apart and fix it on hand. And so they've done that a few times. They do maintenance on board. They recognize you got to have simple, easy maintenance because things will break. And if you can't do it there with the parts on hand, you're in trouble. To my mind, that the shuttle is going away is maybe the best thing that could happen for ISS, because it is, as far as I'm concerned, nothing more than a prototype interplanetary spaceship. And having less capability from the ground means it has to become more self-sufficient and independently capable. This is one of the things that happened with the Russians with Mir. Because the Soviet Union was falling apart during Mir's lifetime, they spent several years where the ground could do little for the astronauts on board of Mir. So they had to function on their own, and they learned how to be independent and maintain the station to a great extent, independent of the ground. And that's needed if you're going to be in Mars orbit or in Jupiter orbit or in the asteroid belt. You got to be able to function on your own. And we don't yet have the robust engineering for long-term space, human space.
The life sciences, yeah. The one thing, Tim, I am really in solid agreement with you is I believe the biggest challenges of all are on national attitude and policy, because we don't have the kind of attitude and the approach to things that we previously had. And I think the lack of national will, the lack of national interest, the lack of policymakers that probably even know where Mars is, and all of this stuff are much bigger challenges to our civilization moving forward than the life support and technical challenges that we're talking about, as serious as and important as those challenges are. I think we're doing ourselves in, and that's my two cents worth.
Now, that I do agree with you with. I do agree with you on that. That is probably the biggest thing that's in the way. I mean, my goodness, we came up, we built a heavy lift rocket from scratch in a span of a few short years, and we couldn't reproduce the same feat, even though we were using pretty much off the shelf parts. We were pretty much reusing half the shuttle, and we still couldn't come up with it, even with even more money, even with more time. Well, I don't know about more money, but I know more time. They had more time to work on constellations in Aries 1 and Aries 5 than they did the Saturn V rocket, and they still couldn't get the thing off the ground.
Well, see, Tim and Dave, I disagree with both of you. And I think that you're both desiring another Kennedy-esque mission to Mars program that the nation will unify around. And that doesn't happen. It happened by cool. It just was circumstances, unusual circumstances in the 60s made it possible.
I'm not saying that at all. I just think that America is not the same kind of country again. And we don't have the kind of attitude for doing big projects and moving forward and doing
big
things
like that. That's my point. What made the country able to go to the moon so fast in the 60s was not because Kennedy made a proposal when we were in a Cold War. It was because we had an incredibly robust, free, wealthy nation with capabilities so deep it could accomplish anything it wanted as a nation. The nation was what built the Saturn V. Hundreds of thousands of companies, small companies, built that. All putting in their own piece of capability. You need to have a robust, wealthy, free society with many innovative capabilities to do anything. And if we have that, we will go to Mars. But if we look for a president or a national unified program, it won't happen. We have to have the society free and creative and independent first. And when you have that, you'll go wherever you want.
Well, this is let me try to clarify things with you. We're not talking about
one at a time, guys.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Tim.
Go ahead.
Okay, let me clarify things. I'm not talking about a Apollo program. The Apollo. All right, not having another Apollo program this time to Mars or such is just really what I'm trying to say is. As a symptom of a larger problem. Let's look at the Transcontinental Railroad that was built in the 1860s. All right, let's look at the Empire State Building. I heard it took less than a year to put that thing up.
18 months.
Look at the Hoover Dam.
Right. Very fast.
Now look at the Twin Towers after they're knocked down during 9/11. 10 years later, is still a big gaping hole, a big gaping hole in the skyline where those two towers used to be. It's like we're pure paralyzed. We let the nanny, the nags, and the nannies of the world literally paralyze us. And that is what I think does it more than anything.
Tim, but your examples are demonstrations of my point, because the Transcontinental Railroad was not a government project. The two companies that built there was more than two companies, actually, but let's say the two companies that were building, competing from different directions, were part of a robust railroad industry that could build railroad for profit anywhere they needed it as fast as needed. And this was just another one of those many industrial projects going on. Similarly, the Empire State Building was a real estate project for profit to rent, you know, office space. And it was done for profit. It wasn't a government project. The reason you can't build, let's say, railroads today is because they're government projects. You can't build the World Trade Center today because it's being run by the New York City government. I lived in New York City. That's the most dysfunctional government you could imagine. So they can't get it done, but they're not building it for profit. They're building it for some government mission. And the reason we're paralyzed now is because we don't focus on letting freedom function. If profit is the motive, we will get to space. And I think that we're beginning to see profit being reasserted as our primary goal for getting to space now after 50 years of following the Soviets in their style of doing things.
You assume that everyone in this country wants and idolizes and thinks positively about profit. And I don't make that assumption.
Oh, I don't make that assumption either, but I will tell you that I think attitudes are changing. We grew up at a time where profit was evil. We were very Sovietized. Communism had its
I didn't grow up in that era.
David.
Are you kidding?
And we're both older generations.
I didn't grow up. And I grew up in the 40s and the 50s. Profit was not evil at all.
Roosevelt's era, the idea of profit has been for decades evil, and capitalism evil. We were raised with this tone in our society. Despite winning the Cold War, it's not been considered politically correct to extol the values of profit and self-interest. And I think that's my generation and maybe yours.
Not mine.
About the 40s, 50s, 60s.
Sorry, not mine. I'm older than you, but not my generation.
Well, you're only 7 years older than I am.
And it wasn't that way in Oklahoma, for sure. God, are you kidding? We were capitalistic oil industry. We were rah-rah, sis-kum-bah. Through school, even it wasn't until Vietnam that at least I paid attention to changes. They may have been changing before Vietnam, but you know, you couldn't help but ignore the changes once Vietnam.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the cultural was the place in the 60s that changed the attitude.
That did change it, absolutely.
I, the concept that government is bad, good, and profit is bad. And that's what I'm talking about. And I'm seeing that changing again. But I don't presume that everyone agrees with me on this, but I do see the overall cultural trends. And I see the rethinking its approach to things, and that I think good. And I think the existence of SpaceX is an illustration of the changing trend. That's where I'm coming from.
Well, and I think, you know, the future of our space industry rests on SpaceX. So we'll see. Tim, what else do you want to add to the discussion?
I want to add something to what y'all said about the changing attitudes towards profit. You wondered whether or not that sort of trend was really happening in your generation. Well, I can say this for certain, that the squeaky wheel always gets the grease, and I think that the people who have the most hatred for profit, the Marxists and the socialists, they tend to scream the loudest out of the bunch. Sure. And that may be some of it right there.
You're correct, Tim, but the problem was that from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, the squeaky wheels, the Marxists, the socialists, were successful in winning the day, the political wars. And the trend is changing now. They scream, but now they're looked upon more and more as little babies having a tantrum rather than having a valid position. This is how I perceive the political trend. I'm not really expressing my opinion here. It's how I'm seeing, not my opinion of what I want to happen. I'm trying to express what I think is actually going on as a cultural trend from a historian's perspective. And in the long run, we'll see what happens. I mean, but if we don't have profit in a robust, competitive industry, we are not going to Mars. We can make any plans we want, but we are not going to go. You need to have that robust industry. in a sense, the industry is developing because multiple nations are getting involved now, and they're also competing, and that's establishing that industry, and so that's one way we'll go.
I think we need a really healthy, it's going to be a private public partnership, but not like we've known before. And without a private sector that can do more than carry its weight but carry the culture, I don't see it happening going to Mars. And I'm 65. I would love to see humans going to Mars in my lifetime. I'm really skeptical that I'll see that. I really am.
I'm positive we won't see it in my lifetime, David, and I'm 58. So, and I just think that's because the difficulties are involved. I would like us to be aggressively on the way there.
Jackson, in another note, says, I could not agree more, especially the last sentence. Unfortunately, I don't know what last sentence, which one he's referring to. It might be my last sentence in my email to him. He said, we will probably go to Mars with humanoid robots like R2, and that is absolutely going to be a precursor of putting footprints on Mars.
Maybe.
I'm pretty sure.
Robots there.
No, I think we'll continue to do that, and I think our robotic program will continue to go strong, and it should be, and it should.
Yeah, and that's the scouts. So the preliminaries leading up to the manned mission, there's no question of that. And there'll be many more unmanned missions as we lead in that direction.
So Tim, you're an aerospace engineer from Huntsville, from the university there. What are you going to do when you graduate? Are you going to work these problems, or where are you headed?
I'll tell you the truth. Right now I'm working, and the school isn't paying for my PhD program, and I can't afford it anymore, so I dropped out.
Are you working in the industry, or are you doing something different?
I'm working in Army Oil Analysis Program. So I'm sort of working as an engineer, just not the field, particular field I was shooting for.
Too bad.
I already hear that.
Maybe.
You know, there's a lot of things, but it's Huntsville's. It's got a lot of how to put it, a lot of groups doing things over here. And I get to work with them, so I think it's a pretty good trade-off.
Okay.
All right.
Stay in touch with us, Tim.
I will.
Thank you, Tim, for calling.
All right. No problem. Bye-bye.
Listeners, if you want to call us, and there is still time, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So, Bob, if you and I aren't going to be around to see humans on Mars, and that actually really does disappoint me. I cannot tell you how that disappoints me, because I so much want to see humans on Mars. For human spaceflight, what do you seriously think you and I will be around to witness?
I'm hoping and I'm praying that I'm here for a robust, I use that word a lot, but a robust, competitive, free industry in space with profit being made. I keep waiting for that first suborbital ticket, you know, to be actually bought and sold and flown. That happens, and then I know we're on the way. And I'd be very happy to see that. I would love to see a permanent lunar base.
Do you think
we'll
do that?
Because I know we need to do that to learn how to get to Mars and build colonies on Mars. You know, the high goal here eventually, so once again, people forget, the goal here isn't to explore these places. It's to put human settlements there.
Well,
people
but
to live.
That's your goal, not necessarily the goal of other people in the space field.
Well, granted, but in the long run, that's what the goal is. The Spaniards came to the New World to get gold, right?
Right.
But in the long run, they built colonies. And the British came to the New World and made money on tobacco. But in the end, what do humans do? They built places for people to live and work. And in the end, that's what we're going to be doing. And so everything we do, that's the end result. And we should be aware of that. And, you know, many of the dreamers about space say we should do it so that we have humans on multiple planets to survival of the species. Well, that's, once again, you have to be living and working as human beings in those environments to make that work. So that's the inevitable goal no matter what. And I want to see us getting closer to that. That's where I stand.
Do you think we will see that permanent lunar base? I had a guest on, I guess, 2 weeks ago who said we'll never see a permanent lunar base if the government does it. It has to be relevant to commerce back on Earth, and it has to make money, and the private sector has to do the permanent lunar base.
He's right. I think he's right. But, you know, you could have a, once again, the, I think of the colonies in the New World, both Spaniard, Portuguese, and British, and French, and they all tried different models. All of them work to some extent or another. The more government-type models were the Spaniard and the Portuguese. The more private enterprise, independent, freedom concepts were the British. And the British model worked best. And it's one why the United States became a superpower. And the Spanish colonies really fell to the wayside. They never quite were able to match. And so that's where I come from when I make those comparisons. But nonetheless, I think private enterprise profit always was, in the end, required for any of those colonies to work.
What should we be on the lookout for? I know we're coming up on 2 hours, so.
Yeah, I really, yeah, I have to get off. But I would say, once this is the summer, it's the budget battles is the thing to watch, because they're going to influence everything that happens. Those budget battles for the overall Congress, you know, federal budget, influence now strongly everything that's going to happen. And
will they influence commercial space, the private sectors, too?
To a certain extent, because, you know, the subsidies are coming from the government.
Right.
You know, and so that's absolutely the case. They will influence how it unfolds. I don't think they will stop it. They'll just simply influence how it unfolds.
And maybe the timeline.
Yeah, and the timeline, exactly.
Real quick, any comments about bats?
Too long a story. We'll have to save it to
Well, good or bad for the bats?
Bad for the society. You've got organizations that are working very hard to get the bats listed as endangered species, as well as other organizations working very hard to have all government land shut down to access for humans to protect the bats. And in both cases, it would be detrimental for both the bats and our society if those actions.
All right. Next time you come on, we're going to lead with the bats.
Okay.
Well, I would say I'll see you in orbit, but that's not likely.
No, we won't see orbit. Till next time, David.
Till next time. Okay, thank you very much. And listeners, that's it for today's program. And then you want to come back tomorrow. We have our regular Tuesday night space show program tomorrow. And this is a normal week. Next week, we've added in a special Wednesday night open lines program for next week. Thanks to Bob Zimmerman and all of you who have participated. And until tomorrow night, goodbye from the Space Show.